So I'm standing right now beneath the I-40 overpass that crosses over Jefferson Street. If you listen, you can hear the groaning of the girders as trucks whiz past on their way out of Nashville toward Memphis. And I'm here because there's a mural, kind of a memorial to the heyday of Jefferson Street. There's Fisk, and over there's TSU. There's the Ritz Theater, the only place in the city where, during segregation, African Americans could watch first-run movies. And here are some scenes from Jefferson Street's nightclubs, Ray Charles. And right over here in the corner, this is Jimi Hendrix. He's got his headband, his purple robes, the left-handed guitar. And he's on this mural because right here at this overpass is where Jimi Hendrix got his start. Right here on this spot. From Nashville Public Radio, this is Curious Nashville, where we find the answers to your questions about Music City. I'm Chaz Sisk. Today we're going to tell you about Jimi Hendrix in Nashville, but this isn't just a story about one musical superstar and his time here. It's about a corridor at the heart of Nashville's black community. We'll hear from people who knew Hendrix when he was a struggling guitar player, about the vibrant nightlife that once thrived here, and why creative people are still drawn to this street. Jimi Hendrix is just one character in a much longer tale.
This is Joe.
Joe Grammelspacher is the listener who sent us the question about Hendrix.
Well, I'm aware that Jimi Hendrix had played on Jefferson Street along with other R&B performers. Like, it's very vague what I know. That's why I think it's an interesting question. I'd love to know more about that.
Joe works in the IT department at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He's 64, and he's a music buff. When I ask him whether he prefers vinyl or CDs, he tells me about a high-definition format that he says is better than both, something Neil Young's into. As you might imagine, Joe loves rock and roll. He did see Hendrix. It would have been the summer of 1970 on a stop in Evansville, Indiana. And yes, Joe has gotten a few Hey Joe jokes over the years.
Hey Joe! I still get it today. Walking through the office, people start singing that song to me.
I was going to give you one myself this morning, but I chickened out at the last second, so, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
They don't get to that. They don't usually get to the point, where did you shoot your old lady down? But I usually just start with, hey, Joe, and stop.
I'm going down to shoot my old lady. You know, I caught her messing around with another man.
It would be so interesting to time trip and go back and walk down Jefferson Street then on a Friday or Saturday night and see what the vibe was like and everything, you know. That would be so cool.
The clubs on Jefferson Street back in the day when we had all of the live music consisted of the Club Baron, the Black Diamond, the Club Stillaway, Del Morocco, Brown's Dinner Club.
Lorenzo Washington doesn't have to imagine what it was like to walk down Jefferson Street in its heyday. He was there.
This street used to be the mega of music, live music, back in the day.
Nashville really jumping all night long. I'd rather be in Nashville than to be way that on.
To quote a song by a local musician named Cecil Grant, Nashville was jumping.
Some of the biggest stars, Ray Charles, Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington played at the Del Morocco.
I see Count Basie played there too. And
yeah, Count Basie played there. Count Basie was a really good friend of the owner of the Del Morocco.
The Del Morocco was a Jefferson Street dinner club, elegant enough to attract luminaries like Joe Louis and Jackie Robinson, yet gritty enough to feature burlesque dancers. Jefferson Street attracted all kinds of musical styles, jazz, soul, blues, but the biggest sound was R&B, and by the time Washington started tagging along on a friend's singing gigs, the scene was already producing hits. Songs like The Prison Airs, Just Walking in the Rain.
Just walking in the rain.
The first recording of Everlasting Love.
Open up your eyes, then you realize here I stand with my everlasting love.
And the song Sunny, which Bobby Hebb wrote, sang, and took to number 2 on the pop charts.
Sunny, yesterday my life was filled with rain.
Hebb's story is especially interesting. He was a Nashville native who got his start performing as a street musician. Hebb wrote Sonny after his brother was knifed to death outside Jefferson Street's Club Baron. Among people like Lorenzo Washington, the incident is still remembered darkly.
Sonny, one so true, I love you.
So there were some things that took place in some of the clubs that wasn't what we felt was popular, for sure.
Bartender, bring me a drink.
Jefferson Street's history goes back nearly two centuries. It started as a wagon trail linking the Cumberland River to a plantation. When those slaves were freed during the Civil War, many stayed nearby in a Union encampment. But Fisk University is what made the area take off. Revis Mitchell is a history professor there.
We need to realize that when Fisk opened in 1866 on the first day, about 300 people had signed up to come. And by the end of the first year, there were more than 1,000. We don't have 1,000 students at Fisk today.
Fisk, and later Meharry Medical College and Tennessee State University, churned out professionals. Many stayed nearby after graduation. They opened medical practices, pharmacies, funeral homes, shops, and restaurants. Mitchell grew up in this neighborhood.
And with regards to aspirations in the black middle class, this is what you want. This was the American dream.
In the era of segregation, this was a place where blacks could thrive. At the Ritz movie theater, they came in the front and could sit in the best seats. In the stores, clerks waited on them. The doors of the clubs were wide open. Whites were allowed, even welcome for the most part, but they were the outsiders. Mitchell recalls one white salesman who worked a route along Jefferson Street.
My grandfather ran a restaurant. Well, I was surprised because the salesman who I know, Mr. Bill, every day he would take lunch at my grandfather's restaurant. But I asked my grandfather, I said, why do you make Mr. Bill sit back here at a table in the back? He said, well, he wouldn't feel comfortable sitting out front. But if I went to a white restaurant, they'd make me sit in the back. Now, this is a man I don't think of as very aggressive, not a civil rights pioneer. He just understood the moral ways and folk ways.
Jefferson Street had a pull on blacks all over the city. And it wasn't just the music club, says Lorenzo Washington.
There was barbershops, there was grocery stores, it was pharmacies, it was liquor stores. We had all of that going on over here.
Washington recalls walking nearly an hour from his home in East Nashville to get to Jefferson Street. He'd come in whatever pair of shoes were his best at the time, even if they didn't fit well. More than 50 years later, he still has foot pain.
So it was almost like a different culture because we felt as though we were so much poorer. Coming from where we lived than folk in North Nashville. North Nashville was a little more superior to the different communities, and partially because there was so much going on over here, you know.
Today, Washington runs a studio and rehearsal space on Jefferson Street. It also includes a small museum to its music scene. Washington's walls are covered with pictures of the musicians he saw play Jefferson Street. One shows a young Jimi Hendrix, though I missed him on first glance. Hendrix is posed with two other guitarists in front of a stage. He's clean-shaven, and his hair is conked back. And he's wearing a sharp-looking suit, pretty much the opposite of the mystic hippie that Hendrix would become later.
He was a young man at that time. He was only like 22.
And right out of the military, too.
And right out of the military. Yes, he was.
If you grew up in the 1960s, or maybe even the early 1990s, like I did when grunge was big, you might remember that Jimi Hendrix was from Seattle. What you might not know is that Hendrix left Seattle not to play guitar, but to enlist in the Army, and that he wound up at Fort Campbell with the 101st Airborne. Hendrix would later say that jumping out of airplanes inspired his music. It's also where he formed a band with a bassist named Billy Cox. After their discharges, they moved to Nashville in the fall of 1962, where Hendrix rented a cheap room next to a beauty parlor. But why would Hendrix come to Nashville? Why not someplace with a bigger blues and R&B scene? Why not Detroit, or Chicago, or even Memphis? the biographies of Hendrix gloss over Nashville, and everyone I asked had a different answer as to why he came here. Only one person actually knew.
Really, when he wanted to make his break to New York, Chicago, L.A.'s a larger city than Nashville, I said, well, we got to start somewhere.
That's Billy Cox, the bass player Hendrix met in the Army. Cox says it all started when he and Hendrix were playing a Clarksville club called the Pink Poodle. They called themselves the King Casuals, and they were already good. That's how they caught the attention of the Del Morocco. Its owners offered Hendrix and Cox jobs playing in the club's house band.
The reception was great. We came back, me and Jimmy discussed it. He said he didn't want to come back to Nashville. So it was a little convincing. We wound up in Nashville, Tennessee.
The money playing Jefferson Street clubs was pretty good. Little Richard claimed he could rake in $100 a week, even before he was a star. That's nearly $1,000 today. Nashville also had one of the nation's best-known R&B stations, WLAC.
Now, I know you got to have some soul, or you wouldn't be listening to old John I, because I got me some soul.
WLAC's signal could be heard from the Canadian border to Jamaica and as far west as Kansas City. It did for black musicians what WSM did for white artists, says the Country Music Hall of Fame's Michael Gray. A decade ago, Gray helped organize a retrospective on Jefferson Street.
And Little Richard said, I think the first time he ever heard Tutti Frutti on the radio was on WLAC, and because WLAC was playing that record, he knew it was going to be huge. He knew it was going to be a hit.
Even Hendrix listened to WLAC when he was at Fort Campbell, and later he'd play with some of the artists that he heard. But by most accounts, Hendrix butted heads with the musicians on Jefferson Street. His sound was already vastly different. Frank Howard is a singer who performed and recorded with Hendrix.
Jimmy was an innovator. He would do things on stage and on his guitar that nobody else around here would think about doing. I mean, you don't be playing, taking no, you know, or you don't be playing and grab your guitar and start picking with your teeth while you're in the middle of somebody else's show, you know. And I don't think he did his showboat. And I just think that was him. That was his personality. That was Jimmy.
Hendrix was not thought of as a budding guitar hero. More admired was a West Tennessee blues guitarist named Johnny Jones. Even Hendrix would swing through the clubs when Jones played, taking note of his solos.
Hendrix would sit there and watch, and he said, how you do that? How you do that? And Johnny would tell him. But Johnny would tell him also, you will never be the guitar player that I am, because I am the best.
There's a story that Hendrix and Jones eventually squared off in a guitar duel, and that Jones won. Later, some claimed it was only because Jones had better amplifiers. Nashville wasn't the right fit for Hendrix, so after only a year here, he hit the road. But that didn't always go well either. He played guitar for Little Richard, but the two kept clashing because Hendrix wanted to wear fancy shirts and wouldn't cut his hair. He quit the Isley Brothers because he thought their music was boring. Curtis Mayfield fired him for destroying an amplifier. Eventually, Hendrix wound up in New York and started gigging clubs in Greenwich Village. That's where Chaz Chandler, the bassist for the Animals, heard him. Chandler was moving into music production, and he'd recently heard a great new song, a tune that had been kicking around the rock scene about a guy who shoots his wife and hits the road. Hey, Chandler thought, in the right hands, Hey Joe could be a hit. Then he heard Hendrix play it in a club. Hendrix's version had the right mix of rock, blues, and soul. Chandler whisked Hendrix off to England, where he became a star. Meanwhile, Jefferson Street was beginning to unravel. Throughout the 1960s, students at TSU and Fisk were major organizers of civil rights protests. But by the end of that decade, their peaceful marches had started to give way to rioting that damaged Jefferson Street businesses, including ones that were black-owned. And with desegregation, middle-class African Americans had the option of doing business in other neighborhoods. Law enforcement also tightened its scrutiny of the nightclubs. Around the same time that Hendrix left Nashville for good, in 1963, police raided the Del Morocco twice. The first time they came in search of gambling, but found no evidence. A month later, they were back, arresting the club's owner for serving minors. Next, the city claimed back taxes, and it sued to take the building in 1965. Finally, in 1968, the Del Morocco building and several other clubs were demolished to make way for Interstate 40. Lorenzo Washington says the route was not an accident.
There are people that says there were motives for the interstate coming right through Jefferson Street. And
But do you feel like there were motives, or what do you think?
Yeah, I feel as though there were some motives to cut off the street, to cut off the marches, to cut off students between Tennessee State and Fisk. There were suspicions.
I-40 was rammed through North Nashville over the objections of local residents and business owners. The freeway would alter the shape of the neighborhood forever. Revis Mitchell, the historian, says it was part of a bigger cycle of neglect. Interstate 40 sent a signal that Jefferson Street was being abandoned. That led to the city giving it less attention, pushing the district deeper in the hole.
One of my delights growing up was to take my money and go around the corner to the Jefferson Street Bakery. The donuts were fabulous. Yeah.
What happened to the bakery?
It closed.
Why?
Not enough clientele, not enough service.
These days, students at Fisk and TSU are more likely to stay in the Gulch or 12 South than Jefferson Street, says Mitchell. He can't blame them. For more than a century, Mitchell's family lived in North Nashville. But for him, it's just not practical.
Where do you live?
What part of town?
I live in Brentwood.
In Brentwood?
Yeah. Well, services, schools, my son, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful place to live.
Yeah. I agree with you. I know what you mean.
Live?
I live in Green Hills.
All right. Yeah.
To be clear, I'm not black, but yeah, I also live in a neighborhood that's much better off than the place where I grew up, for pretty much the same reasons as he does. A neighborhood is basically a collection of small individual choices like these. People make them based on what makes sense for them in a particular moment. That makes the reasons why a neighborhood rises up or falls hard to pin down. Highways are just one part of the equation.
Interstates went through every inner city. I think somewhere in there, the joy of what people were doing, they lost that joy to do it. But that's been years and years ago. Why can't we bring that back?
Jennifer Carpenter is a poet and a restaurant owner. She and her husband, Carl, opened the Garter Brunch Cafe in a decaying boarding house on Jefferson Street 7 years ago.
Everything was pretty desolate. People thought we were crazy. We were bringing this upscale concept to an African-American community in a time where we were in recession. But I could see this vision of more than just that day. I just knew that it couldn't stay like it was. And I wanted to be a part of the beginning of that change.
On a recent night, the Garden Brunch Cafe opened up for an art crawl. Carpenter and her husband are African-American, and like the artists who put their works on display, they were drawn to Jefferson Street's history as a black neighborhood that fostered creativity. But Carpenter says race can't limit the neighborhood in the future. Half a century after formal segregation ended, Jefferson Street has to remake itself as the place where all people come together, she says. White, black, Latino, Asian, and Middle Eastern.
Because when we decided to do this, spiritually I had the vision that this was a place for everybody. One thing that really bothered me, being from the North, that Nashville is so separated. It's still very black and white.
Carpenter believes that, in time, genius every bit as great as Hendrix can be drawn to Jefferson Street again. In fact, he or she might be there already, honing their talents until the day they burst into stardom. Curious Nashville is produced by Nashville Public Radio, and the questions come from you, our listeners. Go to curious.wpln.org, and you'll find vintage photos of Jefferson Street. You can also help us decide what question we'll take on next. Our theme song and some of the music you heard is by Poddington Bear. You can find it on the Free Music Archive. The rest is off the Country Music Hall of Fame's two-volume compilation of Nashville R&B Classics, Night Train to Nashville. It's excellent. It won a Grammy, and there's not a bad track. I'm Chaz Sisk. This is Nashville Public Radio.